There have been so many new sites with a connection to the Civil War established, even just within the National Park Service, in the last 20 years. And sites like Boston African American National Historic Site, the new Reconstruction Era, and this National Historic Site, Fort Monroe, the even Women's Rights National Historic Site, there are so many sites that have Civil War narratives and Civil War connections that are seeing great increases in their visitation and where there is a lot of public enthusiasm. I don't think interest in the Civil War is dying. I think it's changing, and I think that's great. If we look at the state of scholarship on the field, it is lively, it is vibrant, it is diverse. At the Civil War Institute, during the sesquicentennial, we marched through year by year, taking each year of the war from 2011 through 2015. We like this framing model because it let us talk about a whole range of different ideas and topics and themes in the course of every summer's conference. We got to 2015. We thought about the next year. We said, we need to do Reconstruction, but will anybody come? We were worried. We put together what we thought was a fantastic program, but we were worried. And it filled. People were so enthusiastic. They had great questions. They brought so much excitement and so much willingness to question and rethink things and wrestle with ideas. I take that as a tremendously hopeful sign for the future of the field.
I wonder too, though, that's a good segue into another question that's in my mind. So we've talked a lot about revising the narrative, both from principal actors and also revising the scholarship. What role do all of us have in the revision? You mentioned sort of coming with good questions, coming with an open mind, you know, coming with a willingness to challenge a park historian or in a classroom, you know, to learn from a professor. Is the revision solely unidirectional, you know, from scholar out to the public, or does the public have a role in sort of continuing to revise and expand our conceptions of the war? And actually, Judy, maybe I could start with you from a classroom perspective with your students. How does that process work in terms of revising and evolving the scholarship?
Well, like Rachel, I always ask them at the beginning what their, you know, sort of what are their preconceived notions coming into the class? What are they, you know, what do they think about the war? What do they learn about the war in their high schools? What brought them into the classroom? It's usually a relative, right, who dragged them to something or who talked to them about something, and they sort of, you know, stumbled into the classroom and they didn't have a whole lot of thought about it before. And you know, I used to take a poll with my students and just ask them sort of what was the main cause. I asked them what were the causes of the Civil War. We sort of chart them on the board, and then I ask them if you had to choose one. You know, if you had to choose two, then choose two, and then if you had to choose one, what was it? And it used to be when I first started teaching, however many years ago, slavery never won, right? It never won, and that might be because where I was teaching, I was teaching in different places. Maybe I landed here in Pennsylvania at the right time, but I think it's also changed quite a lot in 20 years or so. Because it always does now. I mean, there's never, they always want to talk about the other things, but slavery's always, you know, I don't have to, I sort of have day one plotted out, and I don't have to do that anymore, right? So we can sort of get on with it, and we can talk about the other things. So, I mean, I think in part, I think we have less work to do maybe with our students with, you know, convincing them of the master narrative that we as scholars have settled on, right? You know, anybody who reads James McPherson or read, you know, watched Ken Burns, you know what the master narrative is, right? The good guys won, right? It was about slavery. Slavery came to an end. The good guys won. And, you know, that's, and I don't have to do that work with my students at all anymore. But I think that there are lots of other things that our students then push us to think more about. I think I keep up with my students in a way more than the other way around. So they are the ones that are pushing that revision. Yeah, I mean, if I'm upset that I'm not teaching Civil War right now, is I'd take them all to the new Harriet movie. But I'm going with Dr. Harrison. Where is she? Where's Dr. Harrison? Yeah, there you are. We're going.
I think I love what Judy said here, because I have the same experience with the coming of the war, but I find that Reconstruction is still quite a mystery to most students, and that it's possible that a lot of Civil War classes just didn't engage with Reconstruction for some years. But now we, as both a scholarly community and as a society, I think accept better that Reconstruction is part of the story of the Civil War, and that's where things get confusing. Reconstruction is pretty confusing. It's pretty hard, yeah.
Let's quickly poll the audience. Reconstruction, that's a familiar term to folks, show of hands?
Yeah.
Henry Louis Gates, you watched the PBS series, right?
Yeah.
For whom is anyone unfamiliar with that term? Okay, I just want to make sure we're all sort of working from the same.
So I think Reconstruction is really tricky, because once we establish that slavery caused the Civil War, then you think, well, the Civil War ends and slavery's gone, and, well, that's it, right? I mean, isn't that it? But it isn't. Reconstruction is a critical part, because it's thinking about how to put the country back together after the Civil War, and what are the consequences of the Civil War. And I find that is a lot harder for students, especially, to handle. And a lot of the questions I've gotten where the students are pushing me is making historic comparisons to today that I haven't thought of, or that I sort of wonder, where does that come from? And some that are much more obvious, right? Probably the most obvious one is impeachment. We're in the midst of talking about impeachment, and that's that is an important Reconstruction era story, Andrew Johnson being the first president to be impeached. And, you know, he's not convicted in the Senate, but it's a really important story in thinking about the relationship between congressional and presidential power, and so that is coming up in the classroom. Had a lot of students ask questions about the Electoral College. Abraham Lincoln, of course, won the Electoral College, but did not win the popular vote. And so students ask questions about that, because they're, well, you know, in this modern context, how do we feel about that? Well, there were four candidates in 1860, so it was a different kind of scenario. Political parties were very different in 1860 from what they are today. They were much more in flux, they were fluid. And voting was totally different in 1860 from what it is today. But it makes you as a scholar and as a teacher think about what are these issues that students are thinking of, and how do they tie to the mid-19th century?
What do you think, Stephen, from your perspective? What role do visitors to the parks have in continuing to expand and grow our narrative of the Civil War, memory of the Civil War?
I think that's a great question that we've been grappling with for quite some time now. So I think it's a dual challenge on the Park Service perspective of continuing to expand the narrative, provide a platform where these voices can be shared with the general public, and also connect people to the national park or public lands, right? With the centennial of the National Park Service in 2016, you might have heard the Find Your Park campaign. That was huge for us, right? And we've seen an uptick in visitation dramatically over the course of the last 5 to 6 years. And so one of the things that I've really been challenged with is I have people reach out to me all the time, including groups that I would, excuse me if I might say, generically refer to as ethnic groups or organizations, different, diverse, you know, from different cultures and stuff, that say, hey, would you mind leading a hike through some of your parks and show us around? And that's been pretty big for me, because I took one group out. It was a very diverse audience, people from all different parts of life, different cultures. And I just made stops along the way. I mentioned the first stop would be talking about my father, his service in Vietnam, and kind of how that connected me to the American Civil War. And every stop we made, I just had someone in the group describe why they were there or tell us why they were there. And it was extremely emotional. There were people that said, I was never connected to public lands. I never went to national parks before. Until now, and I never felt that welcome. So that's a big emphasis on what we're trying to do moving forward here. So as we're able to connect more diverse audiences to national parks and public lands, unsurprisingly, the narrative has continued to grow.
And we have a more diverse country.
We do.
And so to find ways for people to connect with that history on a personal level as our country changes just seems to make some sense.
True, and I'll just share, you know, I've got personal accounts where people, like, I've never seen an Asian park ranger before, you know, and I'm like, I don't think I have either, actually. And, you know, and now, by the way, I know several, right, but it's going around the country, but that's kind of one of the things we're talking about. We want people to come in to see the uniform. We want them to feel welcome and that these are their lands as well as ours, and that, you know, if they kind of just look beyond, reveal a layer or two, I bet you they could find a connection to the wider narrative and story as well.
So I do want to get you all into the conversation and give you an opportunity to ask questions. I'm going to ask one more question for all of our panelists, and then we'll get the microphones circulated around the room. And my question is sort of very bluntly, why does any of this matter still? So why does it matter that some people still have an incorrect understanding of what caused the Civil War? Why does it matter if some folks in Oklahoma or Pennsylvania or Michigan are enamored with the lost cause narrative? Why does this matter in 2019? What's at stake in these debates? And I'll start with you down the line, but from your perspective as a scholar and a historian.
The Civil War is a lot about our national consciousness, right? Who are we as a nation? And we often talk about the Civil War as our second founding, right? Civil War and Reconstruction, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, which are foundational to our constitutional order and to our democratic order now. A few other amendments that are also important, the 19th Amendment, of course. But this is a really foundational moment in our history. And so part of the problem is asking who matters in that history. And when we eliminate slavery from that story, when we remove it from that story, who matters is white Americans. And that is a problem if we want to understand our current society, if we want to understand the meaning of those amendments, if we want to understand the meaning of what the country promised to African Americans after the Civil War and then took away. And so it gives us a lot more context for where we are today. And it is about inclusivity and thinking about who is part of our national story.
I would second that, absolutely. And when I think about Gettysburg in 1963, you know, there were sort of three main interpretations of the meaning and the purpose of Civil War commemoration in the 1960s. There was a school of thought that thought we should commemorate the Civil War because it will help bolster our unity as a nation, unity that we desperately need as we face a wide range of adversaries across the world. Then there were those who said we should foster our memory of the Civil War because it will be what we will draw upon to fight federal interference. It will be what we draw upon to push back against this domestic tyranny. Then there were those who said we should embrace the memory of the Civil War as a light that will guide us on to being a more just and equitable society. All of those interpretations, of course, are simplified. The Civil War gives rise to a wide range of interpretations, and those who fought it for a wide range of purposes. You can make all of those arguments. They're all based on certain interpretations, but not all interpretations are created equal, and not all interpretations take us to the same place as a society. I was thinking as you were talking about working with students and students' ideas about, of course, slavery is the cause of the Civil War. That's what I see with my students. That's what I see with the vast majority of people who come to Gettysburg. Yet I think we shouldn't forget that Pew Center poll in 2011 that said that, what was it, like 58% of the American public thought the Civil War was very important, but less than 40% thought that it was about slavery, and that those under the age of 30 were more likely to say it was about states' rights. Those aren't the students I see in my classroom, but the fact that on the eve of the Civil War sesquicentennial, less than 40% of Americans still thought the Civil War was about slavery, I think gives us a great deal of insight into why we as a nation continue to have conversations about injustice and the roots of injustice.
That was great. I'd like to start with just saying a word or an idea of just diversity and really diving deep into what that means in regards to why is the Civil War important or understanding the Civil War. And if we go back to the Civil War, we have accounts, firsthand primary source accounts from everyone that was involved, soldiers, their families, you know, people in the military, people that were civilians, African-Americans, both enslaved and free, both in uniform and not. They were struggling and grappling with the meaning of what this country meant, with what freedom meant, right? And then so as we commemorate these sites after the Civil War, the soldiers come back. What do they want to remember? They want to remember their heroic deeds in many ways, right? So when we read the dedication of a lot of these monuments, they talk about this moment in their life. I mean, it was the pinnacle moment in their lives, the Civil War was. And then as they pass away, well, you know, what? How do we commemorate these sites moving forward? Well, I'll give you an example of that. One of the Civil War sites in D.C., most of them were acquired by the federal government in the 1930s. And so we go from commemorating Civil War sites to really using urban space around Washington, D.C. for family and entertainment. One of the sites was Fort Bunker Hill in Northeast Washington, D.C. 1930s, the Civilian Conservation Corps came in there, put in a bunch of fountains and trails. The fort itself is pretty much gone. A really cool outdoor amphitheater. And there's church services there, right? And they do this for decades and decades. I gave a program out there last December. I had a gentleman come up to us in the program. He said, I've been waiting for you to do this. And he says, I remember, he's an African-American gentleman. He's like, I remember coming to this park when it was segregated during the summertime for summer camps. And all of us kind of like dropped our jaws. I was like, oh my goodness. If you don't mind, you know, could you share some of your experiences here, right? So understanding and connecting visitors to why we commemorate these spaces, I think is one of the most important reasons why is the Civil War important? I mean, look at that legacy right there, right? There are communities in Washington, D.C. That were founded by former slaves or these contraband camps around the city, and they have been in the city limits for 150 years. And in many cases, they don't feel connected to the parks. It's because of the way we've, in many ways, narrated the Civil War, right? So to make them feel connected, to understand, it better helps us to understand our history as well.
I guess I would just add one thing to those comments, and that is to say that that the unresolved issues, the war did was ended slavery, right? And we built a new infrastructure into our Constitution, right, in which we enshrined citizens with certain rights, which were ambitiously and energetically enforced for years. They didn't sort of just immediately disappear. They lingered on for decades after the war. But then they did disappear. And I think we still haven't gone and gone back and sort of figured that problem out. I mean, slavery and the racism that informed it continues to be a raw wound in this country, and it has not healed. And as long as it hasn't healed, we'll continue to talk about the war. And it's important that we talk about the war actually knowing something about it and not irresponsibly and the way it often is done by people who don't know anything about it. So I think it's important for us as smart people who read things and as scholars who study these things to be out there in front of this conversation and not let those voices of ignorance dominate this very important conversation.
I think these debates are as much about the future as they are about the past. So with that, why don't we invite you into the conversation? We have a couple of students with microphones, and our custom is sort of to go across the room and sort of go just across the room like this and then back. Now, I will say, we do audience feedback on all of our events. The biggest piece of feedback that we get at every single event is, can you ask the questioners to keep their questions short? That is feedback that you yourselves have given to us. So I urge you to take your own advice and please ask a question or make a comment, but do keep it brief so we can get as many people into the conversation as possible. And you can address your comment to a specific panelist or you can address it to any of the panelists on stage. I believe we began on that side of the room last time, so we'll begin on this side of the room this time and work our way across. Yes, in the front here.
Thank you so much for all the wonderful things you had to say. My question is about a historiographical trend, Civil War scholarship that I think speaks, that I think can affect public programming as well. And that's the sort of quote unquote darker turn in scholarship. And so that's sort of looking at the violence and destruction, whether it be environmental or bodily destruction. And so I just love to hear your thoughts on what the impact on the field is and has that informed maybe public programming? Because I think that that's a familiar topic to people. But it's gotten a deeper look in recent years.
It's a great question.
I don't do public programming.
So Moira's question was about public programming.
I think you can talk about this a little bit, Judy, but I'll start us off. Let me guess that you are Moira. Yes. Moira's question about the historiography, so the history of the history of the Civil War, so the meaning of the word historiography, has changed a lot from, say, the beginning of the 20th century to the 21st century. So historians at the beginning of the 20th century were really interested in the war as it related to fundamental differences between North and South. So thinking about how Northerners, for example, would have one more urban way of living and Southerners would have more rural way of living and how that might have caused some kind of difficulty. Then it was revised by revisionist historians. They actually called themselves revisionist historians who said that this was not really an irrepressible conflict between two different sides, but was really more of a conflict caused by extremists on both sides, and that it was a needless war. It was not a war that had to come. This, as you can imagine, given the context, was right after the First World War and into the Second World War, and thinking about massive death in those wars and thinking about the consequences of war. Then there was a revision of that, because historians are always revising what previous historians have said, that emphasized slavery and said slavery was the cause of the Civil War, and this is really fundamental to understanding the Civil War. And then there was a revision to that, right? And these are people who said slavery was absolutely the cause of the Civil War, but we're curious about why it happened in 1861 and not, say, 1787. Right? Why was there a Civil War in 1861? Those are the questions they asked. And always, historiography has a lot to do with what's going on at the time that historians are writing. So when the fundamentalists are writing about the importance of slavery, I bet you can guess a lot of that was happening during the Civil Rights Movement. When people were thinking about the importance of African Americans in American society. So now we're in a moment with a lot of endless war and thinking about environmental destruction. And I think that's really affecting the way historians understand the world going backwards in thinking about the Civil War. And so that's why I think we've reached the dark turn. And I think it's important for us not to dismiss the context in which historians are writing. It allows us to understand more about what the war was about. It just means that we tend to focus on some of the issues that matter to us in our current context. Maybe that can start us off.
That's a great question. And I think that the term can often be used as a criticism, right? I mean, I think sometimes people I don't know this, but I would guess that the term dark turn was first coined by somebody who doesn't like The fact that scholars focus on things that are messier, right? They're talking about the war's destructiveness. They've turned away from the sort of recognized battlefields, and they're looking at guerrilla warfare. They're looking at the escalation of violence, right? And certainly, I would imagine that those who've now gone back and looked at the refugee camps. Right, might even, you know, because refugee contraband camps used to be sort of folded into the sort of narrative of freedom, right, that freedom-seeking people left their homes, wound up in these camps, and that was sort of their stepping stone to freedom. And now scholars who work on the period, Amy Taylor, for instance, has just got a book out that has won lots of awards, really, you know, has changed the language in addition to the way we think about that narrative, and is now referring to them as they should be, as refugee camps, and really sort of exposed what really tragic circumstances that freedom seeking people found themselves in these camps. So there is, you know, I think the terminology reflects some of the pushback that's coming maybe from some sectors within the Civil War scholarship. But it certainly doesn't mean that kind of work is not being well received, because these books are winning lots of awards, right? So people like them. They really are doing great work in showing how scholarship can change when we ask new questions of the past, which is right what Rachel was talking about. We were always products of our time, right? And the questions we ask about the environment, about refugees, about all of those things, about sort of the messy guerrilla context, that's shaped by who we are now, right? And that's what keeps right all of the scholarship lively and all of that.
And I'm going to just interject quickly, because I want to get a few more questions on the table, but I think this is a good illumination of how the past, present, and future are all embedded into one conversation. It's not just one or the other. And also, a good thing for us to keep in mind as this series unfolds, revision relies on new questions. I think that's a great point that Judy has brought up. So that's where it starts. And so that's how we understand and learn new things. Let's get a couple more questions. There's a gentleman here in the front row, James, who has a question. Microphone right next to you.
Thank you. First thing I want to say is wow.
Thank you.
I have a bunch of questions, but I want to direct this. When I think of a cause, I think of something like stopping smoking, stopping drinking, whatever. And maybe I'm just a New Englander and I'm not aware of what is the cause that was lost?
That is a good question. Yeah, the cause that was lost was the Confederate nationhood. Right? So the argument that these Confederates made after the war is that they were really just seeking a free state. They wanted to live in peace, away from Union interference, right? And so the cause that was lost is their Confederate nationhood. But it's sort of a double entendre, because they also are saying it's a lost cause that they tried to go to war, because the North, of course, had overwhelming resources and was going to crush them. And so it shows their, you know, valor that they were able to go to war and fight off this enormous enemy. And, you know, it's, as I mentioned at the beginning, it's pretty contradictory in a lot of ways, but this became the narrative that, a feisty Southern set of men went to war to defend their society. That society included slaves, but that's not something that they talk about as much in the post-war period.
Let's get another question, maybe from this side of the room, if there is one. If not, we can work our way back. I think this gentleman has a question here, James, if we can get him a microphone.
Yep. Hi. So the assertion that, yes, the Civil War was definitely about slavery has been pretty prominent in the discussion. So I just wanted to ask, like, what specifically about slavery do you think caused the conflict that spurred the Civil War? Like, was it the morality of it? Was it the economics of it? Like, what about slavery caused the Civil War?
Well, for starters, slaves themselves, the moment that the war began, began to run away, right? And the that eventually meant that the economy that was sustained by their labor started to fall apart. So slaves themselves were made the sort of claim that this war was going to end slavery, that this war was about slavery. They were the loudest and the earliest proponents of that notion that, right, that this war was about slavery, because for them it had to be, right? And they had anticipated the moment forever, right, that there would be a president someday, a party someday, a moment someday that would bring an end to slavery, because this was a Christian nation and it had to, right? So the moment the war began, they began to make the war about slavery with their feet.
Anyone else want to take that one? But specifically about that?
I would just echo that and say that there was a great fear among white Southerners of Northern support for slaves. And some of that goes back to the Constitution. Some of that goes back to the 1850s, earlier in the 1850s. The Fugitive Slave Act, which passes in 1850, requires Northerners to participate in returning fugitive slaves to their Southern states. And this is widely protested by Northerners who don't want anything to do with this, who start getting pretty mad about it, right? And you get John Brown's raid in 1859, where you see a Northerner trying to incite a slave rebellion. And so there's a belief among many white Southerners that Northerners are going to try to end slavery in the Southern states. They also don't like the idea that Northerners want to end slavery expansion, because they believe that's a violation of their political power. So Lincoln's election is a big moment, because all of their fears about who might be in control of the federal government and who might be putting people in patronage positions throughout the South and growing the Republican Party, what kind of effect that might have on their slave societies.
Further questions? Coming back across the room here, gentleman in the front.
Thank you. A question about the history that you're talking about. You talked about five revisions in your last statement, and all of a sudden I'm getting lost. And you say, if we keep moving the goalposts, and maybe it's my very elementary understanding of history, that it's, hey, it's just a series of facts and you make your opinion. If we keep changing and revising, this is my thing, I still have a little issue about the revisionist history. Re-examining, I understand. Revising sounds like there's a narrative. And when does the narrative become the history, and when does the history become the narrative? And how do you avoid that? Because would you be as comfortable with what was said here tonight in University of Alabama?
It's done by historians. If we're talking about historians who are doing research and asking new questions, absolutely, of course. Of course.
In Alabama, how much of the discourse is there a lot of conflict in that, in your sphere, your scholarship sphere? Is there
not among scholars?
No, not among scholars. And revising is not about opinion.
Well,
right?
It seems it's because you're making it say, well, we listen to the people and we do it in the context of where we're coming from. We're coming from civil rights, as you said, civil rights, 1960, in that era. We put on that history the lens of what we were going through.
No, we ask a question based on who we are as a nation at any given time. Our questions change, but we do not come up with a conclusion based on who we are at any given time, and then, you know, sort of layer that conclusion onto a time period.
Let me give you a good example of this, because I think it'll help sort of situate what historians do in the context of other kinds of academic fields. So I mentioned before that there was a group of historians who called themselves the revisionists, who were uncomfortable with the war. They called it a needless war in sort of 1940s. A group of economists in the 1970s started doing studies of slavery and how efficient slavery was. That is not a necessarily a good thing. It just means that it happened to be economically efficient. And they discovered that slavery was incredibly economically efficient. Now, this was not what people at the time thought. Most white Northerners believed slavery was inefficient. And all the way up to the 1970s, people believed that slavery would have died out on its own because it was an inefficient source of labor. Things changed in the 1970s as a result of those economic scholars. And so when the fundamentalists came in and said, slavery caused the Civil War and that's really important, it changed the kinds of questions you could have. So the pushback to that, the way that scholars said, well, yes, I'm interested in this question, but I want to know more about the timing. That happened because all of a sudden everyone accepted the fact that slavery would not have died out on its own, that it would have lived forever, that it could have been adapted to all kinds of other economic pursuits. It could have moved to the north, it could have moved to the west, and you actually saw that during the Civil War when slave labor was used in all kinds of other situations. So this changes the way that the questions happen. So it's not always about sort of the context in which you live, but also about what kind of information is available to you. People read sources and they see new things and they're able to change the kinds of questions they're asking because they see that. So I want to echo what Judy said, which is that it's really about the questions we ask and the way we approach the subject, not so much about just arguing because we believe in something about the present.
Right. And I think a good point about the environmental history, right? We have more information about the environment now than we did 20, 30, 40, 50
yeah,
years
right.
ago.
We have, right?
So we can ask new questions. Yeah,
right? We don't use those anymore. We use all sorts of new data. Those things are available to us now.
But real quick, we are running out of time, but real quick, I think this brings up an interesting question, though, which I've been kind of kicking around. Maybe Stephen and Jill want to hop in on this. Are there some things that can't be revised? Is there something that is so much consensus, so much rooted in scholarship over X number of decades, so much that is fact, that is just factual, it's off the table for revision?
Well, I think there's always a difference between fact and interpretation. There's always a difference between information and how that information is understood and contextualized. Primary documents are not going to change, but the lenses through which we read them are always going to change. I think that perhaps some of the steam and heat that has been generated in conversations, particularly about monuments, I think has reflected that there is often a real divide between the way that professional historians think about the nature of history and non-professional historians do. Professional historians, I think, tend to almost bristle at the term revisionist history because to us it's not revisionist history, it's history. History is consistently being rethought, revised. That to us, that is the nature of what we do. We search for new data, we search for new information, we search for new sources, we rethink what this new data suggests about the information we already had, how we could see it differently. We do apply those questions that have a particular resonance in our own time. We apply those questions to the past. We get different answers. But I think we always think that it's always changing, and we always think that there are multiple interpretations, whereas I think oftentimes when people have talked about monuments, they have said, but this is the history. You can't change the history. If you put up contextualizing information, if you take it down, if you move it, you're changing the history. Whereas historians have said, no, we're changing the interpretation, because that monument enshrined a certain interpretation. It was not history itself. It was an interpretation of history that was privileged over other interpretations. And so what we can do is contextualize that.
Right. And I think that's part of what we're getting at with this series. And it is a fine distinction, and it's a bit messy. I don't think it's 100% clear. We're running out of time, and I'm standing in between you and a free dessert reception, as well as Game 7 of the World Series. So let me do this. If there are a couple more questions, let's take them consecutively, a couple more short questions, and then we can sort of wrap up as using those as a springboard. So, okay, more than a few. Let's get Bob real quick, the gentleman in the back real quick, and then our cameraman who's been working really hard deserves to ask the last question. So, Michaela, you have the microphone? Okay, so James, you're right next to the cameraman, so why don't you get that question first, and then we'll get the gentleman in the back, and we'll finish with Bob, and then we'll debate to wrap up.
How you doing? Thank you all for coming. What I wanted to ask is, while the Union clearly won the war, it seems that the Confederacy has won the battle for historical memory and how the valor and how it's thought of in hearts and minds, and it keeps pushing. So first part of that is, how do we counteract that as historians and kind of tell what really happened, even all the way back to then, because this focus on Southern valor has been going on since the 1870s. And to counteract to follow up with that is, how can we do that knowing that we still have never come to terms, or we don't talk about slavery and what it did to the people who were enslaved in America? Like, we kind of want to get past it, and the American way is keep your head down and push past it. So if we don't ever acknowledge it, is it possible to overcome that?
Okay, so that's one thing to put on the table. The gentleman with the glasses there, yep, you get the next question.
Yeah, I have kind of an opposite question to that.
Great.
I went to high school and college in the 70s, and I was taught that the root cause of the Civil War was slavery. Now, I'm from around here, and I went to school up in New England, so obviously there's a point of view around here and in New England that's different from the South. And I was surprised to hear a statistic earlier, I'm not sure which of you said it, 30 or 40% of the people only think it was the root cause of slavery. What did the rest of them think? I mean, I've never heard anything but slavery is the cause of the Civil War. And it's embedded in my thinking, and it has been since I was a little kid. So what else do people think?
Okay, and then Bob, the final point, and then we'll wrap it up with a conversation that weaves all this together. Michaela, if you could come down. Oh, sorry, or James, sorry. Bob, right there.
Thank you. I want to follow up on the question that was asked by the gentleman in the first row, which is about the politics of historiography. Given that the facts don't change, but historians have the opportunity to select, to organize, and to create a narrative. And Professor Kiesberg indicated that the grand narrative is now conventionally accepted. How did that happen? How is it that the United States Park Service decided that there should be a connection between civil rights and the Civil War? How is it that historians now are reorganizing the data to support the grand narrative? I'd be very interested in knowing how that change was occurring.
So actually, these three questions are connected. It's sort of about the power to shape narrative, right? So it's a question, I think, on all three levels, both inside the federal government, inside educational systems, inside universities. So I'll let you each take a stab at that. You know, how does that play out? Who gets to shape the narrative? How does that power struggle between historians and legislators and general public, how do you see that from your perspective?
Oh, I guess I'm going first. The first two questions I think I can put together to say, I've spent a lot of my career teaching in the South, and I'm taught in Oklahoma for several years, and I would say the preponderance of students in both of those places either believe that states' rights caused the Civil War or that it was states' rights and slavery. So few of them would say that it was slavery alone. And I think the way to get at this is education. And it's hard because a lot of the textbooks that are used in the places that I used to teach were not very good in terms of explaining slavery as the cause of the Civil War. But a lot of my students go on to be high school teachers, and I want them to focus on the Civil War and think about the Civil War and get their students to see beyond the textbooks that they're using in their classes. And I've had some reports from some students who teach in Texas about the textbooks in their classes and the ways that they're trying to change the narrative in their classrooms. And so I think As educators, we're all trying to teach the next generation about how to get at these questions. I challenge all my students to talk to their family members about what they learn in my classes. I want to hear how those conversations go. As it comes to sort of the political nature of historiography, that's sort of a loaded way of thinking about it. I think what historians do is they try to understand the perspective of the people who lived at the time. That's our number one goal, to try to understand that. What has changed is not so much that approach as it is the people that we're looking at. So for many years, white historians only looked at what white people in the Civil War era thought. And when you change the approach of whose perspective you look at, then that opens up all kinds of possibilities. So the method has not changed. We all, I think, subscribe to the method of trying to understand the people of the time. It's just the people you're looking at. And when you open that up, it's a whole new world.
Why did you change?
I think because we have a lot more people in the academy who don't look like me, who are not white, who did not grow up necessarily in privileged circumstances, who are asking questions about people who look like them. Or you know someone who maybe gets you excited about a question that has nothing to do with your background. And so that becomes folded into the methodology because we're starting to teach it more. So as the academy changes, as we become more diverse, as we care more about different perspectives, that helps us open up those questions in the past.
Let me allow Jill to go next. We'll go down the line here as we wrap up.
I would say also as the diversity of our country increases, it becomes more and more obvious that we are a nation of many different perspectives and many different stories, and that all of those stories need to be told. And when they are brought into conversation with other stories, it naturally impacts the way that we have thought about those stories. And so in an effort to not just kind of echo what Rachel has already said so eloquently, I would say that I think much of what public historians are seeking to do in creating conversations around monuments is to get people thinking and talking in careful ways about how narratives are intertwined with power and how the ascendancy of certain narratives is linked to power dynamics in society. And I don't think we're not trying to replace certain narratives with other ones, but rather to emphasize that just because that narrative is the one that's on the big horse doesn't mean that it was the only narrative at the time. There might have been a whole struggle and battle over the interpretation that is put forward in such a neat, clean way that it seems so factual, it seems so, oh, well, this is obviously the way it was. No, actually, if we look at the history of how that particular monument, that particular inscription came to be, it reveals even then it was contested, even then it was debated. What we're trying to do is restore that larger context and bring that narrative into conversation with other narratives.
Steve? I second that, and because like a lot of the questions we're basically referring to, because we hear this a lot, you guys are erasing history. You guys are erasing this this history of the war. It's like, no, we're not. The battle walks will always be there. You can come to the battlefields and learn about battlefields. But as these distinguished professors are talking about, read what the soldiers say. Who are they writing home to? The soldiers aren't fighting every day. And this is something that I learned from Dr. Pete Carmichael from Gettysburg College. He says, the further you dive into the Civil War, the further you get away from the battlefield. And I'm like, oh, no. You know, I love learning about flanking movements and, you know, command and control on the battlefield, which I still do, of course. But the soldiers aren't in the field that often, right, until really 1864. But they write home quite a bit, right? So we start reading soldiers' letters. And then we start reading letters that are sent to soldiers. And they're very specific about what's going on in their lives, in the encampment, their thoughts on the politics of the war, how they believe the war should be won. I know a gentleman was talking about coming from New England. Well, their thoughts on the war change as well. We talked about the lost cause. There's also what they call the just cause as well, the narrative that the union was, you know, morally better, and so they had to destroy this, you know, the slavery in the southern states in this war. And the soldiers evolved during the course of the war. Politicians evolve over the course of the war. You ask Abraham Lincoln in 1861, what, you know, he explicitly says, if I could keep the country together without freeing a slave, I would do it. In 1863, as African-American soldiers by the thousands are enlisting, you know, he starts asking himself, how can, you know, if they're going to fight for this flag, how can we deny them the right to vote? You know, and voting for the franchise equals citizenship, right? So as my colleagues are talking about, that the narrative of the Civil War in regards to the war part has always been there. We'll continue to talk about it, but we can't, you know, the idea is if you go out to a battlefield, Antietam, all the way out west to Vicksburg and Stones River National Battlefield and all these different forts and stuff, the armies just don't show up there, right? I mean, who is Robert E. Lee reporting to as he invades the north into Pennsylvania? He's writing to Jefferson Davis, the political commander of the Confederacy, correct? So you have to intertwine those. They just don't show up there. That's why I believe the narrative, as we talked about, it's become a lot more complex, and it continues to get bigger and bigger. We are finding more primary source material. A lot of it's being digitized online now, so we're learning stuff about the Civil War that we've never even considered before. Or can you imagine if you're a historian writing about the Civil War in the 1930s, the stuff that we have found almost 100 years later? I mean, their view of the Civil War, I assure you, would change as well.
Judy, the last word?
I can't top that. That was really good. I would just say, Brian, I think we'd call this halftime. Maybe the Confederacy, maybe the Lost Causes, you know, has sort of won up until now, and maybe, you know, maybe 150 years from now, people will be saying, you know, when did it shift? How's that?